Hi, my name's Steve, and I'm here to tell you all about the DC Comics News Podcast. Every week, my friends and I sit down and discuss everything DC. Movies, TV and streaming, comic books, and everything in between. But don't just take my word for it. Here are a couple of our sponsors. Listen to the DC Comics News Podcast. It's audio justice.
No. It's audio chaos. These wackos are crazier than I am.
Well, maybe you're both right. Whatever the case, you can find the DC Comics News Podcast on every podcast platform.
Apple Podcasts.
Google Play.
Spotify.
Stitcher.
And everywhere else you find podcasts. So, can I go now?
Let him go. He did everything you asked.
Comics in Motion is proud to be sponsored by Renovations Press, home of the world-renowned Tracksuit Man, the story about traveling to which we can all relate, and something we've all missed this last year. Renovations Press continues to make the decades-long quest to bring quality independent comics to the masses, with three comics each year featuring the supergroup / government experiment gone wrong, Section 12. Click the link in the show notes for more information about how you can buy some high-quality independent comics. And stay tuned, because each time a new issue comes out in 2021, Comics in Motion listeners will be eligible to win free copies of Section 12. Click that link, check out Renovations Press, support them on Patreon. You'll be happy you did. What started as just an appearance on Indie Comic Spotlight has turned into an excellent partnership between Comics in Motion and Renovations Press. We look forward to bringing you some amazing content.
Store, and therefore there are going to be some real life things that happen, and I'm sure you'll recognize them, but I just wanted you to know that this is what actually happened today. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Classic Comics, everyone. My name is Matthew B. Lloyd, and I'll be your guide as we explore the world of comics before the advent of the Silver Age. Thanks for tuning in to the Comics in Motion Network. We've got a lot of great shows for you, and I can't tell you how excited I am to share this episode with you. Today I have a special guest, Mr. John Hitchcock. John is the owner of the local comic store I go to here in Greensboro, North Carolina, called Parts Unknown. I first met John 20-some years ago when I was in college. It's actually probably 30-plus years
Thanks
now.
A lot.
Thanks I'm a lot. Older, too.
I have the college kids come in for a 10-year anniversary, and they go, "Just want to tell you, man, I'm here for my 10-year anniversary." I said, "That's great." He goes, "You're the only thing that's the same. Everything else in this town's different." I said, "Well, thank you."
John, tell us about your comic book story. How did you get into comics, and how did you get your own store?
Well, it's funny. I had an older brother that used to buy comic books, and they were, of course, you know, I come from a Marine Corps family, and I didn't go to the Marines, but my brothers did. And they were all really absorbed about especially my brother Spark. He was really into DC War. And
Sergeant Rock and
Haunted Tank and our Fighting Forces and stuff. And he would give them to me. He would just say, "Here, you shut up. You know, you're waking up too early in the morning. We're sleeping late." Here's and I started to read them, and I was obsessed about reading and rereading them over and over and over, and it really got in your head, you know, how much I enjoyed this. And Flash, a couple of years later, was at the beach, And he gave me a quarter to go buy you two comics. And the one I remember clearly was the second chapter of Adventure Comics with the Legion of Superheroes with Starfinger.
Uh-huh.
And I remember reading that. If I had bought the first issue and never got the second issue, I would have been a destroyed child. But I really got into that. And that gave me the clue that I could actually go and buy these things. And I was also very, very fortunate because there were a group of guys in my neighborhood. Specifically, there was a guy named Billy Cummings who was about 3 to 4 years older than me. And he was an artist and loved to draw. And he approached comic books from a totally different perspective. He wasn't interested in getting all the numbers sequences and, you know, complete runs of certain things. He was more interested in the artists and the people that drew them.
Uh-huh.
And that's about the time we're talking about 19. I decided I was going to start collecting in 66. And a buddy of mine, his name is Rusty Gleason, took me downtown. He knew where all the newsstands were. And we went downtown and I bought, I had a newspaper out and I made like almost $12 to $14 a month. So I was the rich kid in town.
That's good for back then.
Yeah, back then. But this is in 66. And I went downtown and I bought like Amazing Spider-Man 55, FF 67, I think it was, Daredevil 33, Marvel Collector's Item Classics 12, and Not Brand Yet number 5. And you're saying, how can you remember that? It's just, once again, I read them over and over and over and over. And I decided that day, that I said, I'm going to collect comics. I mean, this is what I'm going to collect. When I was a kid, I collected Butterflies and Moths.
Yeah.
I collected matchbook covers. I collected rocks. I mean, I collected, you know, pennies. And then when it hit comics, it just became the thing. And a big part of it was because, like I said, Billy Cummings was into the art end of it. And the idea of comic books are an original American thing. And the power of them is the power of storytelling. And the guys that were great were the guys that knew how to tell a story. And that was the priority. Their priority was to tell you, to take you and tell a story visually as well as they possibly could. We're meeting guys like Will Eisner and Harvey Kurtzman and Jack Kirby, Wally Wood, and Alex Toth. I mean, guys that were grand master storytellers and knew what they were doing and would work themselves silly to get the thing done right, I mean, as best they could. And so when that happened, and I started hanging around a guy and then meeting a couple other guys that were into drawing. And I draw. I'm an artist. I got my Bachelor of Fine Arts from Greensboro College. And I got my teaching degree there, too. I was obsessed with collecting comics. And I'd mail off to New York, Robert Bell, and the Passaic Book Center. And I would order through the mail and try to complete the runs of certain things that I had because And part of it was because I wanted to read the stories. This is before they had trade paperback collections and things. And,
yeah.
And it just kept growing. And then in the early 80s, they started putting out comic books that were only sold in direct sales stores. And the first one that I can remember was like...
Is it Ronin?
Ronin was one of them, but I think the first one was... what's the roller derby girl from the X-Men?
Dazzler.
Yeah, won, yeah. And then of course the Frank Miller Wolverine miniseries was only sold direct sale, and so all the kids in Greensboro were going crazy because there was not a comic book store, and we used to caravan to Winston-Salem. Heroes had a store in Winston-Salem, and yeah. You go in and you find Kazar, Micronauts, certain things that were only direct sale. They were trying really hard to promote the direct sale stores. And you buy your stuff, and then one day we just said, God almighty, I mean, we're tired of driving. Greensboro is a big town. Well, there were these two guys, John Butts and Tom Wimbish, who were big comic book collectors and once again, artists, very talented guys. And they approached Mark Austin, who was a money guy, who was also a big comic book fan. And they started Acme Comics in 83. I was the first employee back in 83 because, you know, I would help them pull subscriptions and stuff. And for the first few years, I worked for free. I mean, I didn't even work for books. I just wanted the store to succeed.
Yeah.
Because by God, I didn't want to drive Winston-Salem. And then
you get your comics.
And then in 1989, I'd worked there for almost 6 years and decided if I was going to do this, basically, I got to give it my own shot. And so I opened up my own store in 89, and we've been open 31 years since then. Seen a lot of comics, sold a lot of comics. And it's the one job I've had. I mean, I was everything from a bag boy to a paper boy to a bag boy to working at 7-Eleven, managing a 7-Eleven. I did a lot of things. But the one job I've always had that I love to go to work is this. Is you don't have to argue with me. If somebody's sick, I'll come in. Yeah. No problem. I get to sit around and talk about comics. Well, needless to say, I can talk. So, as you just found out.
But. Absolutely. Well, there are a couple of things about you and other stuff you've done, like your Alex Toth book, and I know you've got a wrestling book.
Yeah.
Would you share a little bit about that? Because I know a lot of the people that listen to this stuff. Yeah, share a little bit.
Well, the Alex Toth book is the Alex Toth doodle book, and I struck up the start at the beginning. The first guy I ever wrote a letter to that I didn't know was Wally Wood, and he had put a ad in the Overstreet Price Guide, and he basically said that if you want to see another story by him, you need to go ahead and buy this book. And he was reprinting the Sally Forth and the Cannon books, and he was basically his own publisher, and he would sell everything through the mail. And so I wrote a letter just saying, hell yeah, I want Wally Wood to stay in comics. I love Wally Wood, and who doesn't? And I bought two copies of the Sally Forth number one book, one for me and one for my old buddy Billy Ingram, who helps me here on Book Day. It's funny that we have friends that go on forever. They're all, and a lot of the hook is comics.
Yeah.
And so I got this package in the mail. It was a nil envelope, no packing in it, just flat and nothing got beat up. And I got it and I said, well, Wally Wood wouldn't write me a letter. He lives in a castle on a hill somewhere. 2 days later, here comes a postcard in the mail from Wally Wood, handwritten. And I'd ask him in the letter if he would mind signing a few comics. And he said he'd love to. So I mailed him a stack of comics. And we started a correspondence where we wrote back and forth to each other. And he wrote me a letter. You can go on TV Party website, and the Wally Wood letters are on there. You can actually read them. We put them up so people can enjoy them. Al Williamson told me, he said, Wally Wood wrote you that many letters? And I went, yeah. And he goes, he never wrote me a letter. He said, you must have write good letters. And I said, well, he always made fun of me because he always said, you get a lot of Dear John letters. And I was like, yeah. Anyway, so I wrote to Wood, and I found it fascinating that he didn't have hardly any of his own comic books in his own collection or his files. He just didn't have them. So I felt kind of guilty about that. So I started mailing him old comics. I mailed him Mad, like issues 6 through 23, and a few other books, a few Strange Worlds, and a few things that he did work in. And he was very appreciative. He said I was the first person that ever sent him something instead of asking him to send them something. And he sent me an original page, which was cool, but he didn't sign it to me. And then he sent me a copy of Mask of Dr. Fu Manchu, which was his file copy. It was well read, but he didn't sign it. So I mailed that back, and he signed it. But he didn't sign anything to me. He just signed his name. Well, anyway, so it was really cool. I was writing to Wood, and sadly, his health started to fail. He had high blood pressure. He had a stroke. He had lost vision in one of his eyes. From what I understand, that kind of was a coming and going kind of thing, but if you're an artist and you lose your depth perception,
that's bad.
It's very, very difficult to do anything. And sadly, he took his own life, which I didn't find out right away. But still, I considered him to be a friend. And so when he passed, I remember going, well, who am I going to write now?
Uh-huh.
And I was looking at the Comics Buyer's Guide. And all you old timers will remember, Cat Ironwood used to write this column to print. Well, she started printing one column. She printed a bunch of Alex Toth postcards that Alex would do drawings on the front, but she didn't take the address off. And I went, I'm writing that down. Because I love Toast stuff. And so I wrote him a letter, and he wrote me back this fabulous letter back. And and he said he signed some books. So I mailed him some books. And I had the flu, and I was in my house. And my mom goes, you got a big package out here. And I went, what? And there's this package. It was huge. It was you know, and it had all my comics, all of them signed, and a stack of original art in there for free. He just sent it to me. And,
oh, wow.
And so I called him, and he was like, oh, Hitchcock. And we started talking, and we became friends for the rest of his life. I mean, up until 2006. And we used to talk on the phone a lot. And then one day he called me, and he went, John, I just got my phone bill, and we spent enough money to pay for that satellite up there. Because you think I'm kidding, but there were a couple occasions where I was on long distance from Greensboro, North Carolina, to Hollywood, California for like 3 hours, and it would be on me. And then sometimes it'd be on him. And back then, that was like a $50 phone call.
That's
and
expensive back then.
Back then, yeah. It was a fortune. But, you know, he was my friend. And make a long story short, I asked him, I said, well, you aren't really doing a lot of comics now. He goes, I draw every day. And I said, what do you do? He goes, well, I buy these little pads down at the drugstore, and I doodle on them, and then I just throw them away. And I said, well, look, don't throw them away. Send them to me. And then one day, we'll have enough stuff that I'll publish a book. You know, it'll be a little drawing book. And he said, okay, you got a deal. So he could send me a few things. He turned out he sent it to everybody that wrote to him. Always would get a little drawing or something. Mm. And we finally got to the point where I thought we had enough. And good old Billy Ingram, you know, worked with me. He had the computer skills to take the book and take it to the next level.
Yeah.
And the comic book writer, Jeff Parker, financed it. But this is back before, you know, you had to actually have money.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you can do it on Amazon,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and order one copy if you want. But anyway, but we got it done, and sadly, you know, we sent Alex the final draft, and his eldest son Eric told me that he found the package in the Alex's mail, and he thought it was taxes, and then when he opened it up and realized it was this book, he took it to Alex, and Alex at the time was in intensive care, in a hospital, in Burbank, I think, or maybe it was somewhere in the LA area. But anyway, he said, hey, he said, Dad, I got this thing from John Hitchcock. You want to look at it? And he said that Alex was in an oxygen tent. And he went, bring it here. And he put it in his lap inside the oxygen tent and went through it.
Oh, wow.
And after looking at it, he looked at it. He told his son, Eric, he said, if it's good enough for John, it's good enough for me, print it. It was really tough to get, you know, financially to be able to pull it off, but we finally got it printed. But sadly, Alex died a month and a half before the book was printed. But he saw the final draft; he knew what it was going to look like pretty much. And I wish he could have seen it. But knowing Alex as well as I do, he would have bitched and howled that I put this in there and I shouldn't have put that in there. And you know, he would have found fault with everything. But he was such a good guy. But anyway, so I started writing Alex in 81, and then Alex asked me, he said, hey, do you have a local comic book convention around your area? And I said, well, there's one in Charlotte. You know, there's a hero show that's a small show. He goes, well, I'd like to be a guest. Why don't you contact that guy? So I went downtown to Acme, and I said, believe it or not, Alex Toth wants to come to a comic convention. And at that time, Alex wasn't a total recluse like he ended up. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize at the time, but his wife had come down with cancer and he was dealing with that. So he couldn't make it, but he told me, yeah, we'll do it. And so I talked to, you know, Wimbish and Butts, and they were like, we'll throw a con. If we can get that guy, we'll throw a con.
Yeah.
And this is some of the earliest stuff that happened in Greensboro as far as conventions are concerned. The old comic collector, friend of mine, Clay Kimball, threw three shows at the Friendly Center. And Manly Wade Wellman was the guest of honor at the first show.
Oh.
And I don't think anybody knew who he was, but I kind of knew. I'm stupid, but I'm not that stupid. But anyway, but it was, you know, so we started planning to throw the show. Alex didn't make it, but we'd already invited Archie Goodwin and Murphy Anderson. And Murphy Anderson grew up in Greensboro.
Yeah.
His father ran a cab service, and Murphy was a cab driver for a while until he got on with DC in the 50s, early 50s. And so we started throwing comic conventions. And the comic book conventions back then, this was for Acme, were fascinating because we're talking 83 through the 80s. Mm-hmm. You could get just about anybody if you had enough nerve to call them.
To come.
To go to be a guest. And you had to pay for everything, but that was expected too. So the first convention was a total flop. I mean, we lost money. And I remember being at Acme downtown with Butts and Wimbish, and we looked at each other going, man, what do we do? And of course, we had guts. We had a two-day show.
Yeah.
You know? And it was funny because Archie Goodwin had a ball. And somebody came in and said, well, I thought you said Archie Goodwin was going to be here. And I said, he is. And he goes, well, where is he at? He's not behind his table. I said, see the little guy down there with the mustache on his hands and knees digging through that box? That's Archie Goodwin. And he went up and said, hey, you Archie Goodwin? He said, yeah. And he goes, oh, okay, I'll go sign your stuff. And he got up. He was having a ball. I mean, he loved comics as much as anybody. So after that show, we were kind of looking at each other like, man, this is terrible. And Murphy walks up to us and he goes, if you could have one guy as your guest of honor at your next show, who's it going to be? And I swear to God, this is true. We three looked at each other, and at the same time we went, Will Eisner, which is basically like, you think God can come, you know? Yeah. And he said, well, I used to work with Will on, you know, the PM magazine, and you know, he loves doing shows. I'm sure he'd never been to North Carolina. I'm sure he'd love to do it. Let me contact him. I'll get back to you. And I looked at those guys and went, are you kidding me? We're going to have Will Eisner, one of our little show. I mean, it was a little Holiday Inn thing. And about 2 weeks later, I get this phone call from Murph, and he goes, here's Eisner's phone number. He said he'd be interested. And Mr. Lloyd, let me tell you something, buddy. It took me over 2 weeks to get enough nerve to hit those buttons. I was scared. I mean, Will Eisner is like, to me, is like, he is the Louvre. He is it. And to be at our little thing was like, it was kind of embarrassing. I thought it may be insulting, but what do we know?
Yeah.
And I called him, and he was stern, but very efficient about exactly what he expected. You know, we had to pay for the room, we had to pay for the airfare, we agreed to pay for his food, and he agreed to come. And we were like,
okay.
I swear to God, I was like, you got to be shitting me. And we put a flyer up going, Will Eisner's coming to Greensboro. And sadly, Will Eisner didn't do, you know, X-Men, or the turnout would have been incredible. Because you have to know comics history, you have to really know the stuff. Yeah. And so he agreed to come. And then Murphy came back, and Archie came back. We wanted them back because they were great. We had a good time with them. And the Hampton brothers, Bo and Scott Hampton, both came. And, you know, they went to everything. And it was just like one of the weirdest things. It was just like, man, we got freaking Will Eisner at the show. And I did the panel with him. And I did panel with Archie a couple of times. And Archie used to cut up and have a good time at the panels. And you got a minute for this story. When I'm doing the first panel, I've never done one before in my life, and it's probably in front of about 50 or 60 people. And I've got the Maurice Horn History of Comics hardcover book, and I got it opened up to Archie Goodwin's page. And it gets to this point, and everything's cool, but it gets to this one point where it's when he left Red Book Magazine to work for Warren, you know, and start, because he was writing all that stuff. And
right.
Then became the editor. And Archie just turns and looks at me, because it's kind of abrupt the way they said he left Red Book. And he looked at me and he goes, Jesus Christ, John, what are you trying to do? Crucify me up here? And I looked at him, and he was straight faced. And I looked at all these guys, these friends of mine. I looked at them, and I just looked at Archie, and I went, sweet Adeline, sweet Adeline. He started singing, my Adeline, you're the power of my heart, sweet Adeline. Boom, boom, boom. And everybody started laughing. And from then on, it was like a comedy show I would do with Archie. You know, and it would always be fun. It would always be creative, and it would always be spontaneous. And he sent me a wonderful drawing of himself and me doing a panel together. You know, I was down in the back somewhere. Anyway, so Eisner was at the show, and we were waiting for him to get off the plane. And when he came off the plane, I just couldn't believe it. And I asked if I could carry his bag, and nobody would talk to him. Everybody was scared to death of him. And we're walking up the thing, and I said, and I just threw my arm around him. I said, you know, I just want you to know you're my hero. And he goes, you got to be careful, John. You don't know a whole lot about me. The first thing I said, I don't care if you child molester. You still want life. You're the man. You know? And he started laughing, and we're laughing. Everything's cool. And later, I heard that he was really a big fan of fruit. And so I went to the grocery store and got a fruit basket. Mm. And after he got settled in, I went and knocked on the door. And it was great. It's like he opened up the door. And he's wearing his slacks, but he's got one of those hoop undershirts that look like the 1930s characters he was in. Yeah. And I said, well, I heard that you like, you know, I heard down in Atlanta that you like fruit. So I bought you a fruit basket. And he goes, well, come on in. And it was just him. And we sat there for an hour and just talked about comics. And from that moment on, we became friends. You know, I mean, we became good buddies. And I kept up with him. We'd call him when a new graphic novel would come out.
Yeah.
But he was wonderful, and he was, you know, Will Eisner was the kind of guy that he knew how good he was, he knew how talented he was, but if somebody started talking to him about his art, he would, you know, nod and say thank you, and then he felt like, he said, I feel like strangling him going, did you get the story, because he was a consummate storyteller, and he was such a wonderful guy, and we remained friends for up until the end of his life, and we used to call each other, and he was great. And so when that convention was over, we looked at each other and said, who can we get next? and I was like, I don't know. And so what we would do is we take little photographs and we'd write up the conventions and send them to the Comics Buyers Guide. And, you know, God bless, you know, Don and Maggie Thompson, because they would put the pictures up and they put the write up about the show as news, which is cool, you know. And I was like, that's great. And then I got this letter from Alex Toth, and he had tore it out of the CBG. And he went, what the hell is this? Will Eisner, are you kidding me? I mean, no, it wasn't Will Eisner. No, it was, I'm wrong. It wasn't Will. It was after the Eisner show, we got Jack Kirby.
Okay.
And Jack Kirby, we got him because this local guy had his phone number, and we worked it out, and Jack and Ross Kirby came to the show. And he was wonderful, and I did a panel with him. And Kirby was a wonderful man, and he was really kind of funny in a way. But he was having early stages of some form of dementia a little bit. Eisner was talking about that later, that he wasn't quite the way he used to be, but he was wonderfully sweet. If you go to, YouTube and you put in Will Eisner, Jack Kirby, Greensboro, North Carolina. There's a few clips that exist of me interviewing him, so you can actually see what he sounds like. And, and that was really cool. And so the Kirby thing ended up going in. It was another thing that went into the CBG, and that's the one Alex saw and said, "You're shitting me, John. You got Jack Kirby." And I went, "Well, Alex, we invited you." And he goes, "Well, who have you had so far?" And I said, "Well, we had Archie and Murphy, and then we had Eisner, and we had Kirby." He goes, "You had Eisner, Kirby?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, by God, I'm going to be a guest the next show." And that was really cool because, you know, being an obsessed Toth fan, it was so cool. And he was so nice. And he's got a terrible reputation of being a guy who's really, you know, angry, curmudgeon type guy. And I never saw that. I mean, I really did. And, of course, I always was incredibly respectful of him. And I knew that, you know, when he was in the hospital, they found out he was bipolar.
That explains a lot.
Yeah, and when I heard that, it was like being hit in the head with a duffel bag or something, because I'm like, Jesus, man, I should have known, because you could call him sometimes and he'd be quick and smart and he'd talk about comics and art and painting. And the other times you call him and he'd be in depression. He would drag you into a depression about the loss of his wife, Gyla. And, you know, so, but Alex and I were really, you know, really, really close. And he came to Greensboro. It was so funny. He wouldn't change planes. So I had to drive to Charlotte and pick him up in my car and drive him to the show, you know, to the hotel. And then we all went out to eat with him, and he was quick and he was funny, and he was in his element, because everybody there just loved him. And it was a good turnout. I mean, all those shows, the first show maybe didn't do 400 people, but from then on, we were always doing 700, 800 to 1,000 people, which was really great. Yeah. And then after the Kirby, after the Alex Toth show, Will Eisner, Al Williamson agreed to come. And Al came. Al and I had been, I met Al in, at a D.W. Howard show in Asheville, North Carolina, and we just hit it off, and we kept I run into him at conventions, and we give each other a hard time, and we cut up, and I could tell you that story, but it would take too long. But anyway, Williamson and I became tight, and Al agreed to come to the next show. Well, after that show was when I broke off with Acme and decided to open up Parts Unknown.
Okay.
And I opened up the store in, I think it was in the end of July, 1st of August in 89, and I threw a convention in October because I was convinced the best way to throw a show, to get attention to the store was open, is to throw a show.
Yeah.
And the Cotton Mill Square was situated center town kind of thing with a ton of room, and it was all free.
Yeah.
To set up. It really was kind of a free deal.
Oh, wow.
And they were, and the Cotton Mill Square people were really interested in us doing things to promote the store, Cotton but to Square, promote the mall. And so the first show we had in 89, Williamson was there, George Evans was there, Angelo Torres, of course, you know, Archie. I don't think Archie was there. He had to go to San Diego and accept the awards for Marvel, I think. And he was mad because he wanted to go hang out because we all got along. And the Hampton brothers were there, and also Dave Stevens.
Oh,
and
wow.
I knew that Al knew Stevens because Al done a pinup for him in the Rocketeer. And so I called up Stevens, and Al gave me his phone number, and I called up Stevens. And this is great. This is a great way of looking at remembering him. I called him up and got him, and I said, "Yeah, I'm having this comic convention." He goes, "Where's it at?" And I said, "What's in Greensboro, North Carolina?" He goes, "Oh, okay." You can tell he is so he doesn't want to talk to me. And I said, "Yeah." I said, "We got some guest list, and we think you'd be great if you could come." And he goes, "Okay." He said, "Who do you got for your guest list?" I said, "Well, right now we got Al Williamson, Angelo Torres, and George Evans." And he went, "Wait a minute." He said, "You're telling me Al, Ange, and George are going to be there?" He said, "Screw it, I'm there." And he dropped everything and came. And it was not another one of those nicest guys. I mean, I know I'm sounding like a broken record, but he was a wonderful guy. And he was generous to everybody. He was friendly to everybody. I mean, everybody, we were so fortunate, the people that we picked, because they seemed to mesh well together.
Yeah.
So I had that show in 89, and the next show after that was we had Will Eisner come back, and that show was kind of an EC show because Joe Orlando was there, Marie Severn was there, Mike Mignola was there, I think. No, I'm wrong. That was the Boland Wrightson show.
Okay.
And Mignola was there, and that was cool because nobody knew who Mike was because he done like Cosmic Odyssey, and that was it. Before Hellboy,
yeah.
So, but he was a nice guy, and
I remember that.
And we had a really good time with him. Terry Austin was one of the shows, the Eisner shows, and so anyway, we had a great time with that group, and then comics stores were making so much money, we flew Boland in from England.
Oh,
you know
wow.
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, we had so much money. Who do you want to get? Let's get him. Okay. and it was like that, and then the next show. I should have had notes, but this is all top of my head. The next show was the Eisner show, and that's when George Evans and Marie Severn, they came in, and Archie and Al, and we had, and that show was fabulous. The only thing about that show that was kind of awkward is that Eisner told me there for 2 days, and he was there for a day, and then he agreed to come by for an hour, and then he flew out. He had uh-huh. his wife with him, uh-huh. Annie, who was a wonderful woman. I love her to death. And she was, it was so funny. Eisner walks up to me, and he goes, "Well, I got my wife with me. What do you want her to do?" And I was like, "What?" And he goes, "She's really good at stuff. Have her work admissions. She's very talented. She works at a hospital. Blah, 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 blah." And I'm like, "I can't put Will Eisner's wife to work. I can't do this." And God bless, my mother and my sister grabbed Annie and took her to our house and had a tea with her. And she never forgot it. You know, she just died a couple of months ago. Yeah. In her 90s, and she always, whenever she see me, "How's your mama? How's your sister?" I mean, she really appreciated that they took care of her, and
yeah.
because she had no interest in comics. So after that show, I decided to sell out, and I had a show with Kevin Eastman, and the Turtles were the hottest thing in the world. And Kevin was a really sweet guy, and it was so funny. He was there, and we used to have these meet and greets mm-hmm. on Friday, and then the show, and then we'd all go out to eat on Saturday night, and on the one day shows. But anyway, we'd always go, even 2 day show, we still go out to eat. But anyway, we keep together as a unit, you know, and everybody that worked at the show and worked at the store could go with us. And so they got to meet those people, you know, up close and personal. And everything was really cool. And where was I? So we're with Kevin Eastman, and one of the guys that are working for him. Look at that origin book. Who wrote that? Is it Jenkins? Paul Jenkins?
Yes.
Paul Jenkins was basically Kevin Eastman's lackey. This is when Tundra was around. And Jenkins walks up to me, and Eastman walks up, and he goes, "Would it be okay if I smoked a cigarette here?" And this is a big open, you know, convention room. And I went, "Yeah, yeah, they make up here. You know, everybody smokes here. You know, I don't. But, you know, sure, it's okay. It's cool." And he looked at me, and he was like, "Okay." And so Jenkins walks up to me, and he goes, "John, what did he just ask you?" I said, "He asked me permission to smoke a cigarette, if it was okay." And he goes, "I can't believe it." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And Paul goes, "John, do you know how much money Kevin Eastman made this year in toys? We're not talking T-shirts or movies or comics or posters or underoos." He goes, "Do you know how much money he made just in toy sales this year?" I went, "I have no clue." He goes, $40 million. And I went, and he goes, I said, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah." And he's asking you permission to smoke a cigarette. That's what kind of down to earth guy he is. And he, you know, whenever I see him, he kind of remembers. But you know, his life has gone all over the place with the sure. Turtles, and this is, the Turtles were pretty new then. And then we had after that show, we had a show with Jeff Jones agreed to come, and Al was there, and we had a ball. I mean, Jeff was such an interesting guy. And it was so funny because George Evans came back for that show. And it was so funny because I had a friend who collected signed baseballs. So he would take the baseballs to the convention and he'd get the artist to sign the baseballs.
Oh, neat.
And so he went up to Jeff Jones and asked him to sign a baseball. And to be quite honestly, I don't think Jeff Jones knew what a baseball was because that's not him. And he said, "What do you want? What?" And he kept looking at him and like, "Why would you want me to sign this?" It's like, you know, so I was like, "I didn't make the baseball." I mean, and he signed it and said, "Okay, move along." And then he goes up to George Evans and asks George Evans to sign the baseball. Not only does George Evans go crazy, but George Evans grabs the kid, pulls him around the table, and shows him how to throw a slider. George loved baseball. So it was so wonderful. I mean, another guy I left out of that Eisner show was we had Julie Swartz come to the show.
Oh, wow.
And there was not a nicer guy. There's not more knowledgeable guy. He had a memory like a steel trap. I mean, the guy remembered everything, and he was wonderful, just a wonderful man. And I used to keep up with him and talk to him, and he was really funny. He had that classic, you know, New York, you know, Hitchcock, come here, Hitchcock, come here. And I was like, okay. And at the show. It was really funny. That was the one. It was Terry Austin and Julie and Eisner and Archie. And there was I told this story at Julie's memorial at San Diego. Julie was, there was a big argument going on at the end of the table. And of course, Butts and Wimbush and I are scared to death, and we're sitting at the other end of the table. And Julie started this thing and got them arguing. And they were all kind of yelling, not yelling, but they were arguing their points and blah, blah, blah. And Julie Swartz walks down, gets up, smiling as only he could, the Cheshire Cat. And he walks down, he sits down right in front of me, he looks at me, and he goes, "You know, I love to stir them up and then sit back and watch them fight." And we just fell out laughing. From then on, he was our guy. We loved that guy because he was just a hoot. He was funny and nice, and he couldn't have been more considerate of us and went out of his way. If we call him, he'd be there. You know, he did a lot of shows. And then when our shows, when the comic book field kind of fell apart, with the, you know, the, after the Image and there was that implosion, we just financially couldn't throw shows anymore. We were barely keeping the store open.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you know, Heroes have kept throwing shows, but you know, they went from multiple stores to one store. I mean, it was terrible.
I remember.
We did try to revive it a couple of times. We had a show with Jeff Jones and Mark Schultz and Schultz was at that first 89 show with Williamson and Evans and Torres. I kept up with those guys, and I would call them and see how they're doing, what's going on, and kept up with them, some of them to the end of their lives, and a lot of them are still around, but not as many, but it was wonderful. And what was the best part about it is these shows were basically a lie. They really were, because the only reason that we threw the shows is because we wanted to meet those people. We didn't give a shit. We didn't care if anybody showed up. It's nice. We hope everybody's got taste and knows who these people are. But we want to meet them. And every show we had to have one guy that I wanted to meet, or everybody wanted to meet this one guy. And you know, we got real close once to having an EC reunion, and it all fell apart. And I don't want to get into it, but I was actually talking to Jack Davis, to Johnny Severin, and Johnny Craig. And I had them all like right there, and it all fell apart like in a day and a half, and it just didn't happen. And I was trying to get those guys. We already had Williamson and Evans and all those. And then from then on, I just stuck with the store, you know, selling comics to people like Mr. Lloyd and trying to make sure that everybody gets what they want. And then if I'm lucky, somebody will say, hey, man, suggest something. And then you know, it's tough on a retail point of view because you don't know the guy. You don't know what he's read. I mean, he may be a guy who's his whole life has read Richie Rich or Archie, and you're trying to turn him on to, you know, contract with God. You have to make steps when you're a retailer. You have to go a little bit at a time to get them there, you know, with comics. And that's basically... you know, how I got involved with, you know, guys like, you know, Alex Toth, and it got to be one of my best friends with Williamson. And a lot of these guys is that we had the shows and just kept in touch with them. And then sometimes see them at shows.
Well, some people may not be familiar with EC Comics, but I'm sure they've heard of Mad Magazine. Mm-hmm. And Mad may be the most well-known legacy of the company, but EC is responsible for developing a new type of comic in the 50s.
Yes.
Instrumental. I'm going to share quickly. You know, I didn't discover EC, of course, because I'm a little bit younger, till sometime in the 80s, and I found one that had a reprint that had a Ray Bradbury adaptation. Sure. And Bradbury is one of my favorite writers, still is. And then I really didn't stumble along.
How's it going? I saw the open sign out, and I was wondering why you guys were open.
We're doing a podcast thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's okay. You're good.
Okay, buddy. Thanks, Jess.
And then later on in the 90s...
ladies and gentlemen, this is a store. Somebody came in.
Later on in the 90s, when Russ Cochran was reprinting the single issues. And
sure.
Late 90s, I started getting those, and that's when I really sort of figured out what I was looking at.
Sure.
Where did you discover EC Comics?
It's funny because they used to put out these little trade paperbacks, Bradbury collections, and they were all EC Comics stories. And once again, Billy Cummings found it first. It was there was just a series of these little trades.
When was this?
This was in the, I would say, 67, 68 or something.
Okay.
But it's a big leap to know that's EC Comics, and making connections, you know, to figure it out. And then, like I said, there was a real Greensburg had a real interesting group. There was a guy named Walter Harper, who was a school teacher, and he's a big comic book guy. And there was a guy, you know, I could talk about John Butts and Tom Wimbush, and big comic book guys, and of course Billy Cummings. But there was another guy, and his name is Steve Massey, and Massey works with me now here at the store part-time. But they used to come over to my house and look through my comics, and we tried to make trades, but I was always really tough to trade with because I wanted to keep my stuff. But I got this phone call from Steve Massey saying he was going to have a comic book sale. And just before that, he came over, and they said something about, well, if you're lucky, Steve might sell you one of his EC comics. When he said that, I thought he meant like a hardcover book or something. I didn't know what it was. And I said, well, I don't know about that. And they went, if you see it, you're going to want it. And so Steve came over and he had three ECs. It was a Weird Science 17, Weird Science 19, and Weird Fantasy 15. And he was selling them for $5 a piece. This was probably 1969, 70. $5 was a lot. As I told you, I only made about $12 or $14 a month.
That's your whole month.
So. That's like it. And so I bought Weird Science 19 from him. And then later, you know, over a couple of months, bought the other ones. But I still remember looking at that Wally Wood cover on Weird Science 19. It's got this spaceman who's dead, and he's staring at him and through a hole. And Wood's the spaceman's looking out, and this guy's dead, but he's staring at him. He's floating in space.
Yeah.
By the legendary Wally Wood, and I opened it up, and I felt the color palette to start off with was different. They had lime greens, they had off yellows, they had off different colors. It was such a different, and when it opened it up, it vibrated up the page at me. It was just like, boom, 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 boom.
Was that mostly Marie Severin then doing the?
She was doing the coloring, but Wood told me in a letter that he always colored his own covers.
Okay.
He made suggestions, and it also had a story in it called "The One Who Waits," which once again is a Bradbury adaptation by Williamson, and it's partially inked by Frazetta, and Roy Crinkle worked on too. Huh. So I got those. When I saw those, I went. This is a step that you know I'm reading Fantastic Four, collecting Ditko Spider-Man, Kirby stuff, Steranko, Neil Adams, you know. But when I got that, I said, this is something that is totally alien, and it's incredible, and I couldn't believe it. Because it was like a science fiction book with four stories, four complete stories.
Yeah.
It wasn't like you had to read a bunch of continuity. You just sit down and read it. And that opened up a huge door. There were other books that came out that would give you clues, like that comics book that came out that had some EC reprints in it, and of course Pfeiffer's superhero book, which had Golden Age in it, the Steranko History of Comics, which had all those covers in it, and the writing, but once I got that, I said, you know, I'm going to save my money up and try to get these things. And once again, you buy them through the mail, you know, if you would appeal, you know, whenever you could. I learned really quickly. And then I found out through Clay Kimball, who was a legendary local collector, that there were these two guys called the Murray Brothers in Durham who had conventions in their backyard. And that started in the early 60s and ran for a good while until it got so big they couldn't do it anymore in their backyard. It was in their backyard and in their basement. Mm. And they were collectors, big-time collectors. And they donated their whole comic collection to Duke University.
Oh,
and it was like Batman 1. I mean, they had everything.
So Duke has a collection?
Yeah, Duke has a private collection. Yeah, they do. Which is incredible. And they were really sweet guys. They were more science fiction oriented than just comic. But I was always a comic guy. And so you used to go to those shows and you save up your money. And I swear it sounds funny now, but it's like you go to the show and you have like, $50, you know, you save every cent you had. You'd eat, you know, eat tuna fish sandwich, whatever you had to do, you save up money, you go, and you come back, you'd have a few comics, and you'd have a couple of ECs, and you go, look at this stuff, it's incredible. And I learned it real quick. There was, you could never buy EC comics. You had to quit buying comic books from Howard Rogowski. He was the one guy that I ordered some comics from. He used to have these amazing lists of all kinds of stuff, but a lot of comics. And I ordered two comics from him. I ordered two Thunder Agents I needed to complete my Thunder Agent run. It was like number 3 and number 4. And I was so excited to get them. And I got them. And I picked out number 3. And it had like 8 BB holes shot through the comic. And I was like,
what the heck is
what is this? You know, he said, all the comics are at least good condition. Okay. And then the other one was worse. It was the Thunder Agents. And I opened up the front cover. And stamped in green letters was this big stamp that said, do not remove this comic from this aircraft. So I'm like, not only did he send me a comic that was shot up, but he sent me a comic book that was stolen. I mean, I'm not going to front stolen goods. So I said, I can't order anymore from that guy because I don't trust him. There's something wrong. But the EC thing became you know, all encompassing, and they came out with an EC checklist, and then you go through it. Anything that had Williamson or Wood in it, you got to have it because you know it's going to be great. And then it branched out from there.
Well, let's back up a bit. And how did EC start? I mean, I know that it started with.
Well, if you go back, if you go
educational
back,
comics first.
Yeah, well, Max Gaines was Bill Gaines' father. Max Gaines was one of the most important guys in comics history. It's kind of forgotten, but he was the guy who was kind of a salesman, hustler guy, who convinced Eastern Publishing to put out Famous Funnies number one. And they had done they printed a few comics before Coco Malt, things like that, and they'd given them away. And what he did is he said, you know, there's a market for this. So he got a couple of copies of this book, cut out a 10-cent sticker, put it on the cover, took it around to some newsstands, guys he knew, and they sold them all like in a day. And he said, this is a market. There's a market for this stuff. And he was instrumental in putting out the first comic book
in this
country. And and he also...
33.
And he was also a guy that was smart enough that he knew he needed some help doing things because he started publishing some stuff. Popular Comics was one of them. And once again, it was a strip reprint book. But Harry Donenfeld at DC Comics was doing Detective Comics with new material. And he knew that that could be something important. And, of course, you know, the legendary Will Eisner knew it too. And Eisner created his own studio and was producing work as a packager for Fiction House and Quality. And that's where it kind of blew up. But Max Gaines decided he was going to start publishing comics. And he had a group that was kind of, you know, downtown. And Donenfeld was uptown. and he started putting out, like, Flash Comics. And I think he put out All-Star Comics. Maybe Wonder Woman too, and he was so lucky because who's the first guy he hired to work for him? Shelley Mayer, and Shelley Mayer was arguably the first great, not arguably, he's the first great editor who understood comics, that comics were storytelling and he was an artist, and of course he ended up doing Sugar and Spike and a lot of other amazing things.
Scribbly back in the 40s.
You know, he did the Red Tornado. He did.
Yeah.
I mean, he did so many incredible things. And he was the guy, and they were the guys that convinced Donenfeld to publish Superman in Action One. They took the original art, cut it up, and figured a way to place it together to do the first Superman. And then when the Superman came out in 38 from Action One, the comic industry blew up and became a multi-million-dollar industry, you know, very quickly. And because kids went crazy over it. Because, you know, there was no television.
Right.
It was just radio and movies. And comic books were for them. And so Gaines was instrumental in all that stuff. And then what happened was he decided to change gears and he sold out his half of it to part of it was because Donenfeld hired his accountant, Jack Leibowitz, to get involved with the company. So suddenly Max Gaines realized he didn't have one partner. He had two partners. And so he sold. I just read this just the other day. But he sold his half of all these of the comics to Leibowitz and Donenfeld for $500,000.
Oh,
now, this
wow.
is 19, what do you figure, 46, 47,
yeah.
I guess.
That's
just a guess.
Yeah.
And so he was suddenly very wealthy. But he didn't want to give up on comics. So he still kind of puttered around with it. And of course, he started putting out educational comics, which were picture stories of the Bible, picture stories of American history. These were thick, brutish type comics that were cloth bound, square. They looked like they were the same size as comics, but they were square, kind of cardboard cover and cloth spine. And he figured he would put these things out and it'd be kind of like Classic Illustrated, where you sell it forever.
Right.
But he also decided he wanted to do a few other things. And he did, like, Love Comics started to become kind of popular. So he did, you know, Love Romances and Saddle Romance Westerns were starting. He did a couple of things. And then what happened was he was with a guy, Irwin, and it was a boating accident. He was killed. And they claimed that he saved the guy's son. He threw his son to the back of the boat and he was run over and killed. And so that's when his widow told her son, Bill Gaines, that he had to take over the company business. Gaines was studying to become a teacher. I think it was in chemistry, but he was going to want to be a teacher. And he went down there and basically would write checks once a week. And then it kind of caught his eye, and it kind of got him interested. And you know how these things happen. Miracles happen, and suddenly who comes walking in the door looking for work but Al Feldstein, who was a solid artist but no genius, but a great writer.
Yeah.
And Feldstein was hugely influenced by Bradbury. And then the next guy that comes in that is hired is Johnny Craig. And Johnny Craig was a great, great writer and a great artist. Slow artist, but you know, he was instrumental in getting them. And then suddenly these other guys started popping up and starting to work for this little company. And it was kind of funny because it was, you know, Graham Ingalls, who is hands down the greatest horror artist that ever walked the planet. You got to go back to Hieronymus Bosch to find anybody as good as Graham Ingalls as far as a horror story. All the stuff on Walking Dead, all the zombie stuff, it all came out of Graham Ingalls and had those EC Comics, Tales from the Crypt, Haunt of Fear, Vault of Horror. They're all the same book, just different titles.
Yeah.
Tales from the Crypt is the most famous because of HBO, but still. And then the other people started showing up because Gaines decided he wanted to start publishing a horror comic because he was really into radio, and Feldstein was too, Inner Sanctum, the radio shows. And so they started doing these horror comics, and the horror comics, there were horror comics before that, but nothing like this.
Was it a clean break, like the pre-trend stuff with the romance and stuff, and then all of a sudden changes?
He kept the same numbering sequence, which drives collectors crazy, because it wasn't like a Tales from the Crypt number one. No, it was like number 12 or something.
Yeah, it was
like that. It was like weird. But he wanted to keep his second class mailing thing.
Yeah,
because it saved him money. And so real quickly, when the horror stuff took off, he decided he wanted to do, another guy shows up looking for work because he thought it was an educational place, and his name is Harvey Kurtzman. And if there ever was a guy, a top five guys in this field that you can honestly say was a genius, Harvey Kurtzman was one of them. And Kurtzman wanted to do a war comic. First, he did a giveaway comic book about syphilis, the ignorant, ignorant cowboy. And if you ever see that book, it's hysterical, but it gets to the point that you're not supposed to run around, and it's a cowboy story, but makes it kind of weird. But he's this poor, ignorant cowboy got taken advantage by a wanton woman, and he ended up getting syphilis, and then the doctor saved him. But real quickly. Gaines and Feldstein and Craig knew that this guy had something, and they hired him. And he originally started working on horror stuff. And then he got his own books with Two-Fisted Tales of Frontline Combat, which you can't even begin to underestimate the power of those comics. Guys like, the peace movement of the 60s, the hippies were growing up reading comics, and they're reading the Kurtzman stuff because they were war comics, but they were anti-war comics. Like Archie Goodwin used to say, they're comic books about good people being in a bad thing, and it's called war.
Yeah.
And that stuff was gobbled up by all these guys, all these hippies, and they knew that I think the roots of the Vietnam protest starts as a germ there,
mm-hmm.
And of course. They did crime suspense, shock suspense. They did weird science, weird fantasy. And then, of course, you know, the piece de resistance, which was the ultimate, was Mad Magazine, which was Mad Comic for the first 23 books in 52. Mad was kind of a slow seller until they did Super Duper Man by the great Wally Wood. And it blew up. And then, of course, that's when the Red Scare came along about comic books were ruining your children. And it basically crushed EC Comics. That's why they stopped putting out horror. They stopped putting out crime stuff, and they started putting out piracy and valor and psychoanalysis and
the new direction
and extra and all this stuff. And it was really cool. And Aces High, and it was really beautiful stuff. It was incredible. But if your logo, the logo of EC Comics, which churned from educational to entertaining comics. In what, 51, I guess, the retailers wouldn't put it out on the stands, so they're going to be fighting their way, you know, into the poorhouse because they wouldn't carry them. So Kurtzman came up with the idea of turning it into a magazine, because then they didn't have to worry if it was a magazine, they didn't worry about the comics code anymore. And then the ultimate piece de resistance story is Mad ended up becoming a national treasure and became financially one of the biggest moneymaker magazines in the history of this country.
Yeah.
And it all started with these guys in the early 50s, you know, at Lafayette in New York. EC Comics was also the first comic to, there was exceptions like Simon and Kirby always signed their own work. Siegel and Schuster did too, but nobody did it like EC, where every artist signed his work on the splash. So you knew if Jack Davis did something, you knew if Elder did something, you knew if Kurtzman did something, they would always sign their work. There was pride there. And the EC Comics, the other side of it that's really important is they wrote comic books for an adult audience. And the reason why is that Feldstein and Gaines and Kurtzman, all those guys, were in the war. And they were in the military, and they grew up. And when they were in the military, they noticed all these kids reading comic books in the barracks. And they said to themselves, well, think about it. At that time, probably most of those kids in World War II, for example, they probably never got out of high school.
Yeah.
And comic books were written for them because it was written, you know, because they were literally, they were kind of challenged, you know, intellectually. And so he said, look, if these kids are reading this, why don't we write up to our audience instead of down to our audience? And that's what's also separated EC in a huge way. And, you know, what else can be said when they basically swiped a Bradbury story? Bradbury called them out on it, and they worked out an agreement where they started putting Bradbury's name on the cover of the magazine.
Because saying, he liked it. He liked what they did.
He was I met Bradbury many times, and Bradbury loved comics. He used to cut out the Hal Foster, Tarzan's, and Buck Rogers newspaper strips. He loved comics. I got to talk to him once for a while, and he told me, he said, I got him to sign my Weird Science fantasy hardcover book that had Sound of Thunder in it by Williamson.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Angela Torres worked on that too. And I was talking to him, I said, man, this must have really been something. And no pause at all, Bradbury looked at me, and he goes, John, this was the greatest moment of my life. He said, I grew up reading comic strips and comic books, and now every month a package would come with these comics in it, and they're adapting my stories. He said, to have one of my stories adapted by Jack Davis or Al Williamson or Bernie Kriegstein or any of those guys, Wally Wood, he said, I was a kid in a candy store. I couldn't wait to open up and see what they were going to do. And they did such a beautiful job of it. And he said, man, I loved it. I loved it. And then he was later in 54, 55, he was pressured by the Suction of the Innocent and Keith Ivor running for president and the trials. They actually were comic book trials in New York over comic books ruining kids. Yeah, comics are ruining kids, all right. They're getting them to read.
Yeah.
What's wrong with a kid reading, you know? But they didn't take that approach. Gaines was called, and Gaines did good at the beginning, but his diet pills wore out. He got worn out by them. They crushed him. And there was nothing he could do about it. I mean, he was just up against it. And that stuff, it kind of killed EC and left comic books in a terrible limbo up until, you know, DC put out Justice League and Flash and brought back a few things. And then, of course, then Stan Lee, along with the great Jack Kirby and the great Steve Ditko, started doing Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, and that stuff. And that brought comic books back to life. But so many publishers of comics went down. They closed shop. They couldn't sell their stuff.
Yeah.
They were blackballed. And they were only, you know, the only company that didn't fold to the comics, comic code was Dell Comics. But they published a lot of Disney. And they said, we're good comics. So we don't, you know.
We don't have to.
They didn't mess with them. They left them alone, which was a miracle.
Wow.
But they you know, put out a lot of movie adaptations and stuff. Yeah. But that's the story of EC Comics. And I'm probably not mentioning everybody that worked for that company, but so many of them did some of the most finest work. And I asked Williamson about it. I said, do you feel competition working for them? And he said, no, not competition. But let me put it this way, John, if I was bringing a story in and Johnny Craig was there with his story and Wood had his story and Davis had his story. He said, I want my story to suck. I wanted my story to look good, too. So we were pushed to do the best work we could because of the by the camaraderie of the people. They forced them to become better and better artists and become more inventive.
Kind of like a musician, when you play with good musicians, it makes you better.
But if you know, and Al was, you know, Al didn't think of it as competition, but there was an element of that.
I was going to ask you, what do you think made EC different? I think you went to that with the writing up to the audience.
Writing up to the audience, and think about it. There's four stories in every book, and I'm not saying every single comic book EC did, every story was a genius story. But, you know, let's say, for example, you picked up a Shock Suspense, you knew you would get four crime stories. The odds are pretty good. A couple of them are going to be pretty decent. So, you know, it was these wonderful anthology, you know, crime, war, you know, science fiction, humor. So it was, really the only time there was that many talented people in one place, the only other time that even gets close to rivaling it is the Eisner-Iger Studios. Because Eisner at one time in the late 30s had not only Eisner's work in there, but Jack Cola's work in there, and Paul Gustavson is working there, and Bob Powell is working there, and Jack Kirby is working there, and Bob Kane was working there. I mean, there were so many people at different times, but at one time they had a group of guys that were really, you know, Reed Crandall. They had some incredible guys working under Eisner. But the EC line, when you start naming the most important comic artists of the first generation that grew up wanting to be comic artists, almost every one of them, you know, worked for EC Comics. Alex Toth did three stories. Joe Kubert did a few stories. And they all did it because they wanted to be a part of it, because they knew this was really something special. And sadly, it only lasted for about 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, I was going to say some of the artists that, you know, that work there. I mean, it's a who's who of. I mean, for those of you who haven't maybe read anything that's by EC, when you see the stories, the art is just off the charts when it comes
to. Fantagraphics is doing a really good thing. They're doing those hardcover books for like $30.
Oh, wow.
And it'll be like a whole book of Reed Crandall, or a whole book of Joe Orlando, or a whole book of Kriegstein. And you can pick those books up and read them. And see how they matured, their style matured, how they got better. I mean, those things are a real godsend, because it's kind of what we always wanted was, you know, is to get a book that's like a complete book on Wally Wood, and you can read all those crime stories, read all the science fiction stories, all that stuff.
You and I've talked before about a few stories, and The Master Race by Kriegstein always comes up.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Well, it's interesting because Kriegstein was the last guy that was hired by EC Comics to work for them, and I think it's safe to say that he was like a burning star or something. He worked at Hillman. He had worked for DC before that, but he worked for Hillman Comics and did some really creative, smart drawing. He matured as an artist. He started taking it more seriously. He worked for DC for a short period of time and doing some war stuff. But you could see that something was coming. And then he went to EC. And he was like a painter, an artist painter type perspective, instead of just being an illustrator. And he realized really quickly that comic books were comic storytelling is where it was at, and his first story was he inked a Williamson job. That's kind of started out wrong, because he was the wrong. His line work is very linear. Williamson, he inked a Williamson story, and he was using a heavy brush, and Williamson stuff is more illustrative, more line and feathered and detailed, and Al was angry as hell and got Frazetta to come with him and re-ink it, because he thought Kriegstein ruined it. Which is a tough debut, but the next book he did was Weird Fantasy 22. He did a story called Derelict Ship, and you could tell he was looking at Wally Wood, because the opening splash is very, very detailed, very layered, but he knows how to tell the story. He's already matured, and he comes at it as you know, how do I tell the story? How's the best way to tell a story? And soon after that, he did the adaptation of Flying Machine by Bradbury. And that one blew everybody away because he adapted a different style where he kind of drew more Japanese, kind of, you know,
fit the story,
kind of cut, you know, kind of like a like the linoleum cut kind of edge to it. And then he started doing a few other stories, and then Master Race fell into his lap, and it was written by Al Feldstein. I met Feldstein on many occasions. Some of them were great, and some of them were not. But Feldstein wrote this story as a six-page story. And at that time, in like 1953, nobody talked about the Holocaust. I mean, Judgment on Nuremberg, you know, that was not covered, you know, like you would think it would be nowadays.
Yeah.
With the internet and everything, or TV. I mean, TV was just getting started. And what happened was, you know, that core of guys, you know, Gaines, Feldstein, Kurtzman, Kriegstein, they were all Jewish, and they lost family, they lost friends. And so when he got that story, it just blew him away. And he said, look, I want to do this story in 12 pages. I need more room. I need more panels to do this story justice. And of course, Gaines is looking at him like, you're nuts. No, I'm not going to do that. And he argued and he argued, and he finally gave him, I think it was 8 pages, which meant they had to take a page of advertising out to get the thing in there and do a shorter story, I assume.
Yeah.
And it sat on a shelf for a while. And then when they did the New Direction and Impact came out, they decided it was time to put that in that book. And that story is all about the concentration camp. It is not pulling any punches. It shows people being killed, people, babies being killed, the Nazis celebrating with human lampshades, human skin lampshades.
Yeah.
It is one of the most amazing things. And to think that they did it at that time period, it was published, I think, in 54, maybe 53, showed incredible courage, incredible guts. And this thing came out, and the people that saw it, I mean, were just destroyed by it. And Art Spiegelman's always said that when he read that, he wrote a thesis paper on it. And he said that's when he knew that, you know, there was a place for him in comics. And that's basically where Mouse kind of came from, was that huge impression that Master Race had. And for my money, it is still the greatest comic book story ever done. I don't know if it'll ever be topped, but you have to also realize the time period it was done those guys had guts. I mean, they had huge guts. And this was during the witch hunt.
Yeah.
You know, this is when they're going after everybody, and they put a story like that out. It's like, holy moly. And it's still to this day one of those stories, if you ever read it, it'll pop you. It'll drive you.
Sit down. I'm telling you, if you ever read it, you need to sit down when you read it.
Well, I had a guy come in here once, and I had a one of those big Russ Cochran oversized books.
Yeah.
And it had Master Race in it. And I never wanted to sell that book, but when I was gone one day, somebody sold it to somebody, which pissed me off. But I would use that book, and I'd say, you want to know what comic books can be? You want to know the power of storytelling? Read this story. And there was this one guy who came in here, and he read it in like a minute and a half.
Uh-huh.
And I said, let me make something really clear to you, asshole. You just got finished looking at the greatest comic book story ever told. And you only gave it 2 minutes. You know what that means? You're an asshole. And I said, and you just insulted me, and you insulted Feldstein, you insulted Kriegstein. I said, you're going to sit your ass down right now on that floor, and you're going to read this book, and you're going to take your time and read that story. And if you don't, you can just get the hell out of my store. And buddy, don't ever come back, because you don't insult me, and you don't insult this work. And he looked at me like, what? And I was like, I knew him, but I was still, I've had enough of this.
Yeah.
You know, hey, is the new X-Men out? Yeah, great.
Yeah.
They're going to punch each other, I bet. So he sat down, and it took him 20 minutes to read it. And when he got up, he looked at me and he went, oh, my God. Oh, my God. He was like, I didn't know comic books could be that way. I said, yeah. Combos can be that way. Combos can be a serious thing. And it's just a matter of the talent and the dedication and the taste and the effort and the guts of the publishers and the editors to do it. And so that story is huge here. Because I always grab people up and say, oh, you read something? And they all go, holy shit. They lose it. You know? So yeah.
Well, I know I bought a collection from you one time, and it's one of the Impact mm-hmm. issues, right? Mm-hmm. It was an Impact collection, and you pointed it out to me directly when I first picked it up to get some of the EC stuff, and you're like, check this out right now in the store, and I remember I read it in the store.
There's nothing like it, and interesting enough, it's a story about the concentration and story about it take place in like New York with the subway. But it's drawn in such a brilliantly angular style that it looks modern. Even now, it looks modern. You know,
I remember it was one of those stories that it's telling a story about something that happened in the past, but it's mm-hmm. actually the physically what happens in the story is a guy in a subway and he sees somebody looking at mm-hmm. him and he thinks it's somebody that's after him because of what he'd done.
Yeah,
and he kind of panics and he gets chased.
Or you don't want to spoil it. You don't want to spoil it.
Yeah. Well, I want to entice the readers to find the comic, or the listeners to find the comic.
After me saying it's the greatest comic story of all time, if they ain't figured that shit out, there's something wrong.
Well, you're right. You're right about that.
I mean, there are other stories that I could tell you about, but that one is, and it's funny because soon after that, Kriegstein got angry the way he was, you know, at EC, he left, and he went to, of all places, he went to Atlas, he went to Marvel, and did some stuff, and he was fighting for, like, crazy for panels.
Yeah.
And he would do a story with, like, 30 panels or 34 panels on a page. It was like he was obsessed with this idea of more room. And he was basically, what he was doing is he didn't even know it. He was, like, real close from figuring out that you could do a graphic novel and do one long story, you know, do one
right.
long narrative.
Right.
But he ended up becoming a teacher at School of Visual Arts in New York City, I think, and he was a teacher there for years. And every once in a while, I'm sure somebody walked up and said, "Hey, man, are you? And he's like, I guess.
Can you sign my copy of Impact? No.
I never met the guy. He was going to come. We were going to get him for the show. And sadly, he died before he was one of the guys, you know, that we wanted to get. And I kicked myself, but I was just in college. But there was a convention Wally Wood told me about up in upstate New York. And Wood was going to be there. And it turned out that not only Wood was there, but Kriegstein showed up. He never did a convention. That was the only one he ever did. He showed up.
Wow.
And it's just like, holy smokes. You know, and Kurtzman was there. I mean, I think my head would have caught on fire.
Well, do you have a favorite artist that worked in DC? I know that might be a loaded question after talking
Well, I think Kurtzman is my favorite. That war stuff that he did. I mean, he didn't do but maybe 12 or 13 stories that he actually put for the war stuff that he penciled and inked, but he laid everything else and wrote everything else. I think his stuff is still incredibly powerful, and it's funny because he draws in a big kind of Bigfoot cartoony style.
That's very different from Wood or Williamson, but you're really into the storytelling aspect.
Yeah, I mean,
how you tell a story.
Wally Wood, Al Williamson, I can go on and on about the guys, and Al was one of my best friends, and like I said, you know, Wood and I wrote, but Kurtzman's stuff is, I mean, it all does, but the Kurtzman stuff more than anything, I think, really stands the test of time. Really strongly, and not to say that some of those other guys' stuff does it too. It does, especially Wood, Williamson, and Davis. Those guys are geniuses. I mean, it's the weirdest thing that they all gravitated to the same place.
Like, how does that one company get all those guys?
Well, you
to
know,
work together.
I talked
at the
to
same
Jack.
Time.
Talked to Jack Davis, and he said that he was living down in Georgia, and he got a car, and he drove up trying to get work. And he had his car stolen, and he was the last place he went to looking for work was EC, and he walked in, and they looked at his portfolio and said, "Well, okay," and they gave him a script, and he sat down, and I think he batted it out like in 2 days. Davis was legendary for being fast, and brought it back, and they couldn't believe it. They loved it, and they gave him all the work he wanted, and then he made it in New York. But he was that close, just took back it up. It was just, and the word traveled too. I mean, reason why Williamson was at EC is because Wally Wood said, "You need to go here. You need to go here. These guys are great. You know, they're nice guys. They're fun guys. They're super. You know, I mean, you're going to love working for them. They're doing good. They're doing interesting things." And when those books started coming out, a lot of those guys started, like, you know, going around, you know, coming around, going, "How do I get into this?"
Yeah.
And a lot of guys got, you know, shots, you know, Rick Estrada, who is not one of my favorite artists, but he did some of his best work for them. And you know, Alex Toth, like I said, did three stories. Kurtzman inked one of them, but Alex liked the sinking. I didn't, but Alex liked the sinking. He tried to simplify it, which Alex is all for. And yeah. But there was so much there. I mean, there were so many people. I mean, when you start naming the Hall of Fame, it's like half of them went work for that company. And they were they would have Christmas parties and they get Christmas bonuses and they weren't really super tight. Some of them were like Williamson and Torres. Roy Krinkle, of course, was, you know, the Mad Hatter who turned everybody on to illustration, turn of century illustration. He turned Frazetta on and Williamson on, and all those guys on to Joseph Clement Call and Daniel Verge and Fortunio Batania, these turn of the century guys that were just mind-bendingly brilliant. And Al was great because he would then turn on the next generation, the next generation. Yeah. He turned me onto it. He would say, here, take a look at this book. And he'd toss you a book on Joseph Clement Call. And you sit down, you go about five pages and realize your hair's on fire. And you went, and you go, who the hell's this guy? And he goes, oh, that's JC. Oh, you looking at that? I said, I couldn't go 20 pages. My eyes were burning. I couldn't look. It was just too much, you know. Just too much. But, yeah, another thing, too, is the Warren run by Archie Goodwin is just as good as anything that was ever done too. And Warren made no bones about it. He made his money with starting with Famous Monsters, which was a big hit for him. And then Archie Goodwin was there as a freelance writer, soon became the editor. He took over for Russ Jones, who was kind of like a fanboy that was kind of over his head a little bit. But Archie was a pro right out of the gate. And not anything against Russ Jones, but then Archie took over. And there's evidently a legendary story about going to a steakhouse and basically did a presentation. Jim Warren did a presentation and said, we're going to rip EC off. This is what we're going to do. We're going to do a horror book. It's going to be called Creepy. And here's the good news. Here's the good news. We're going to do it. And it's going to be in black and white. And you can do what you want to do. But here's the bad news. I'm not going to pay you a whole lot. But they all wanted to do it because that going to work for a slick magazine, a black and white magazine, comic-wise, nobody ever is almost unheard of. There were a few examples like Erie Comics, and there was a one shot in the late 50s. And of course, when EC stopped putting out regular comics with magazine, they did some picto fiction black and white books.
Yeah, yeah.
And those were they didn't last very long, maybe three issues. But Archie was at the helm and the writer, and Archie grew up on reading comics and the EC stuff, a big Kurtzman guy. And Archie told me that it was no big secret. He would go up to Reed Crandall and he'd go, what would you like to draw a story? Is there a subject you'd like to tackle? And he, and Reed would go, well, yeah, you know, I got a bunch of movie stills and stuff. I'd like to do a Roman story. And Archie would go, okay. And then Archie would go to the library and he would find a story. And that's where Thermopylae came from in Blazing Combat, where he wrote the story for Reed because that's what he wanted to draw. How simple is that? And it works. In the old days at DC, for example, Julie Swartz had a stack of scripts, and they were stacked according to need. The one that deadline was closest was on top, and that's how you determine what you got. You go in, drop off your stuff, get your check, grab the one on the top, and walk out.
You don't know what you're getting.
That's when Toth quit DC because he came in. It's a long story, but he came in. He wanted to do Johnny Thunder. They needed him for Strange Adventures. And he said he didn't want to do that. He said no. And he said, that's it. And he walked out. Legend has it that Alex threatened to throw him out the window, threatened to kill him. I asked Alex. Alex said no. I asked Julie. He said no. But I know there were words. And there were just too much gentlemen at that time to tell me the truth. But I know there was words because Julie decided he was going to play bridge or pinochle, probably bridge, at lunch with a group of his, you know, other editors and writer, other people that worked at DC, and he made Alex stand out in the hall and cool his heels after he finished his lunch. And once he finished his lunch, then he said, okay, come on in. And he did that. Part of it was out of to put Alex in his place, but it showed him up in front of his peer group. Uh-huh. And I'm sure that didn't go well with Alex because Alex had a temper like a firecracker. And he thought for one second somebody was dissing him. he would go off. But that Warren material, creepy, eerie, and of course Blazing Combat, the Archie Goodwin run, which is like the first 17 creepy and the first 11 or 12, maybe 13 issues of Eerie, and Blazing Combat 1-4. Those are, in my opinion, every bit as good as the EC material. But you consider the source. Archie wanted to do more because he loved Harvey Kurtzman. He knew Kurtzman was, you know, right, was doing it.
So that's where the sort of EC legacy ends up, is with Warren in the 70s. Well, John, thank you so much for joining me. I know the thing, in talking to you, we could sit here and go,
just name somebody.
Yeah, and that
the only guys I never met and I wanted to meet more than anything. Well, you know, Jack Cole died before when I was 2, but I never got to meet the great Reed Crandall. I never got to meet Frazetta, although I had a chance, I just couldn't afford to do it. But I met his wife a couple of times, and if you meet Ellie, you don't need to meet anybody else. She was a handful. But I got to meet just about everybody else that I wanted to meet. I was very, very fortunate. You know, I didn't have kids. I had comics, and I would go to these conventions, and I would look, and if they had somebody there, it was like, what, Mort Drucker's going to be there? I'm there, you know. Williamson's going to be in Asheville? I'm there. I mean, I got to go.
Yeah.
You know, I just wish, I wish it could have, I could have met those, but I got to meet I'm so lucky, you know, got to meet, and almost every one of them were gentlemen. They were really sweet guys. It's like they were almost blown away that you even knew who they were. Hmm.
You know? That's the difference in, I guess, the public opinion of the medium at the time and when they were working and now there was no sort of superstar aspect to the medium at the time and the creators, whereas in the 80s and 90s, you know.
Well, you know, you think about certain companies, a lot of companies wouldn't allow the people to sign their name, or if they did, they just kept the same name on it.
They wanted and then the brand. Other people,
You know, I mean, Dick Sprang worked a long time at DC, so did Shelley Moldoff. They're all doing Batman. Bob Kane wasn't doing it. And they didn't, you know, you had to be a real scholar to dig that stuff up and find it out, you know. Yeah. Carl Barks never signed a Comics and Stories or Uncle, you know, he never signed it. Wow. But people knew him because he was the good guy.
Yeah.
So, and that's another thing that these kind of deals are good, are really important in a way because of fans, we have interviews with some of these people. If it wasn't for fandom and people that were, you know, obsessed collectors and readers and stuff, you know, there wouldn't be, you know, interviews with Alex Toth, and there wouldn't be interviews with all these guys. And we're just really fortunate that the fans, a lot older than me, you know, were there and interviewing, you know, Siegel and Schuster and some of those guys, you know. Basil Wolverton, actually, I don't know if they, but his son saved everything. So they're starting to put out these beautiful books, Fantagraphics, from his files, you know. We had a book that listed every job, how many got paid.
Holy cow.
It's incredible.
Wow.
But a lot of it is because of the fans and how obsessed we are. And because of that, you know, there's a really ripe tradition that's being saved because of people that loved it, you know. And when you met a professional, really a guy really, you could become friends with them really quick if they knew you loved it as much as they did.
Mm.
And and it was real fast. You just knew it. Because, you know, we used to have a joke back in the old days. If you go up and you talk to somebody, an old timer, back then old timer was 50, and you bring up Lou Fine or Jack Cole, you're in. You're in. You're in the inner circle. Because if you're smart enough to know who those guys are, you must be okay. Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
No, you thank do you.
Else,
thank
let
you.
Me know.
I was saying, I think there's enough springboards here to do something again. I hope you'll join me for something there. John, where can people find you on social media? The store.
Well, the store's on Facebook. You know, Parts Unknown. You know, we're open 6 days a week and from 12 to 6 and 31 years and counting. I don't plan on closing up anytime soon. I hope to keep the store open for another 6 or 7 years until I hit 70.
Okay.
And So you can take a deep breath. You still get your stuff. But, you know, it's not like you're digging a ditch or you know, in a ring fighting somebody. You're coming in talking about comics.
Yeah.
Trying to help people and trying to find stuff and try to do a good job. So, yeah.
Well,
You take care.
And I'll see you Wednesday when I come back from my comics.
Book night.
If you're ever in Greensboro, please come and see John at Parts Unknown on Spring Garden Street. Next episode on Classic Comics, I'm going to be covering Tarpe Mills, Miss Fury. Miss Fury was the first female superhero created and produced by a woman, and she has an interesting story, not only the end story, but publishing history as well. I hope you'll join me for that.
There you go.
This is a perfect opportunity to tell you how blessed I've been with the comic book shop owners I've dealt with in my life. When I was a kid, it was Shelton Drum at Heroes on Hard to Find in Charlotte, North Carolina. And, you know, as John said earlier, you know, we first met when I was in college. You know, that's almost 30 years. That's 30 years ago. And he has been an absolutely wonderful person to talk to, you know, week in, week out, even, you know, when I miss a week because I'm busy. John is just a wealth of information, and he has incredible stories, and we have only touched the surface on this, on these as we go through this episode, and I cannot tell you how many more I've heard personally in my visits to his store. So, as we briefly mentioned at the end of this episode, you know, we're going to get together again, I'm sure, for, you know, something about a particular artist or whatever. But thank you so much for listening, and I feel so blessed to know both John and Shelton, who runs Heroes, who was the first comic store I went to, and John, who has so many other experiences that have enriched my understanding of comics, and I really hope you'll continue to join me in this journey. Thank you.